I have known Glen Brown's art since the early 1990s, which I guess is probably when Lavinia first saw it as well. I was immediately struck, I think it was at Jerwood, possibly, I saw some of Glen's so-called science fiction paintings, which I loved. And I noticed that some of them had in the title the painting for Ian Curtis. And if you are a person of a particular type, that is a name which immediately kind of sets a kind of keychain code of associations going. And it's what actually turned me on to Glen's art and follow it to the present. And that was for me an interesting example of the way that there are now successive generations of both artists and cultural consumers for whom the history of rock and roll is in some ways a kind of finishing school. It's a university. People make interesting connections because they like a certain type of music. They get into a certain type of art. We're all of an age, for instance, probably to have discovered Andy Warhol through David Bowie, maybe. Then what happened was that Lavinia wrote a brilliant book, which Faber and Faber published, and it was called The Importance of Music to Girls. And again, for our generation, music writing was dominated by men, and it was normally dominated by heterosexual men. There was very little writing during the so-called glory days of music journalism in the late 1970s and early 1980s. There was very little written by women. And so, not wanting to pigeonhole Lavinia's writing in any way by gender, it was fascinating to me that somebody had written such a strong and idiosyncratic book about music using or playing with this notion of gender. And so we met and we discovered we'd been at some of the same concerts together, which included seeing Joy Division. I mean, I saw them several times. I know Lavinia probably the same. And so time passed, as Virginia Woolf says, and we thought, this band, this music, has made a very deep impression on the three of us. And so how can we create a book which isn't attempting to be a biography, because the Joy Division bibliography is now huge and highly, highly political and dangerous to get involved in. I speak as one who is currently getting a foot drawn into the Joy Division exhibition that's happening in Manchester in the summer. So how can we make a book which is really just a way of combining our responses? And we were amazingly lucky that Glen, who is a very, very busy man, found this of interest as well. And Stephen, as a great artist book publisher, found it of interest. And so we've made this book, Joy Division, which I suppose we don't quite understand it. We just know that we all wanted, a bit like the people in Close Encounters of the Third Kind who were drawn to the mountain, you know, we all wanted to somehow get down our response to this music and why should it still have such an effect. So I am not the chair, but that's one version of how we began, and I'll maybe try to pass it to Glen at this stage by asking Glen the very simple question of going right back to those famous iconic paintings that you made well up in the 90s. How did they come to have this suffix in the title, Painting for Ian Curtis?
The story of how they came to start it, it was actually in the Saatchi Gallery in, I think it was New York Art 2, an exhibition that was 1980 something, and there was a painting by Julian Schnabel called Ornamental Despair, Painting for Ian Curtis, and it's a paint, it's on velvet, and it takes the two square panels, one panel just has a wreath painted around the sides in white paint on black velvet, and the other side he's copied in white paint again the cover from Closer. It's a beautiful painting, and I love the painting and I love the title. So I couldn't take the painting, so I took the title. And at the time, I was also had started re-listening to Joy Division as well. It sort of there was a moment when maybe I was at art college when I stopped listening to them, but I stopped listening to music quite a bit, I suppose. But then, after I'd left, I was sort of I bought a CD player for the first time and was rebuying CDs, and I didn't have a record player, so I couldn't listen to all my old records. So it was that rebirth of music again when the CD came around. I was quite late to getting a CD player, I suppose. And so I was making these sort of science fiction paintings, and whilst listening or rediscovering Joy Division, you know, slowly an album at a time, as I would buy them on CD. And the two just melded together in my brain, really. And with the glue joining them together with the Schnabel painting. That sense of sort of isolation and loneliness and despair, but sort of in a very sort of ornamental and grandiose way, I think epitomised Joy Division and the music, and especially the sort of words of Ian Curtis. And there's a lot of associations in his, I mean, he was very well led, as I'm sure you know. And so in his lyrics, there's an awful lot of information there to be gleaned and further reading to be done. That you can, you know, it's just an education itself, listening to a Joy Division album. So that's how the paintings started.
Yeah.
I mean, I came to Joy Division in 1979, which was the year their first album came out. And I was 17, and when you're 17, my experience was I felt I'd been admitted to the adult world and the wider world, but I didn't yet have permission to speak or act within it. I was very silenced, and I had a very big interior life. And this was the year in which, you know, Margaret Thatcher came to power, that we really thought, I think it's the year that the Russians went into Afghanistan, and I couldn't believe the world wasn't about to end. And then I looked about me at 1970s, late 70s provincial England and the absolute collapse of the inner cities, and I thought, no, it's already ended. And the music of Joy Division has about it an architecture dynamics which are all about disused space and about silences and a kind of anomy. And it spoke to my sort of fermenting interior self, which was sort of rather caught up in existential crisis. So rather like Ian Curtis, I wore a raincoat and I carried, you know, Eliot and Kafka and Dostoevsky in my pockets, along with my French cigarettes, you know, and thought this, you know. And so I was drawn to it in a very complete way. And when I went to see, I was also a very anxious 17-year-old, and I remember going to a Joy Division gig, and I was quite far back, I think it was the Electric Ballroom, and just seeing Ian Curtis on stage and seeing him, he was epileptic, this was, and he would have fits on stage, but he would also meld his fits with his dancing. And you know, we were all so young that we'd be looking at him thinking, is he having a fit? But we weren't thinking, I should call an ambulance. And the band, other members have talked about their sort of reticence and also their naivety about what was going on for him at that time. He was a very charismatic young man. I wasn't in love with him or infatuated with him as a sort of pop star. I was him, I felt, you know, that we were both young Werther. We were both kind of these super sensitive, tragic heroes. So for me, it was a combination of an inner self and an outer world, which I think that the music, particularly the arrangements of the music when they went into the recording studio with Martin Hannett, absolutely captured.
Do we have, because you responded for this book by writing,
yes,
you know, some, so I don't know if people can...
I don't know if you can see. When Michael and Glenn asked me to do this, I was both thrilled and panicked, because the idea of, I feel, you know, Michael has immense authority in both the music and the culture of punk and post-punk, and Glenn's work speaks for itself, but I think the idea of writing about somebody so iconic was quite terrifying. And I think in the end I wrote a series of poems which, again, like Glenn, I've borrowed. So this phrase, "It was me waiting for me," comes from the song "New Dawn Fades." And it really captures both the sense in which Ian Curtis, with his epilepsy, his depression, a life, he got married very young, he then fell in love with somebody else. He felt utterly trapped in his agony, in his failure to resolve his agony. But it was also me waiting for me. I was 17, I was waiting for something to happen. And for me, rather than try to write a poem about music, which I think is really hard to do, I'm writing a poem about what I felt like, what I thought he felt like, and the kind of country we were living in.
Do we have another?
Yeah, this one. One of the things that Joy Division did was restore to us, I think a lot of people like me, and I imagine you too, I don't know, at that age, had a huge desire for art, for glamour, for style, for colour, for a lot of things that 70s Britain was very suspicious of. And the sort of the later Joy Division with the, you know, Atmosphere and Closer, this absolutely unironized, monumental, majestic imagery, which translated into the music, was something for me that was also captured by the footage of, they used to rehearse in a disused warehouse. There was no such thing as a disused warehouse now, they're all apartments or offices. But there was all this derelict space. And this text is really, really about that. And sort of, I went to Manchester when I was 19. I was in a band and we supported a band called Section 25 at the Hacienda. And I can barely remember the gig because I was so nervous. But what I can remember is seeing a city which had, it was Britain's first industrial city. It had these enormous, this enormous architecture that was at that point redundant. So this is the Great Halls Were Empty. And then this idea of these very frail images, at Slow Roses also obviously being the breath in the air. And that was really all we could do. And I was also responding, I have to say, to your Slow Roses, as I think of them, mm-hmm. which are in the book, mm-hmm. when I was writing that.
It's interesting, that sense of dereliction, that sort of, literally derelict buildings, which surrounded everybody in sort of 1970s, 80s, even 90s, but to a generation now, there's no such thing as derelict building. My paintings were painted in semi-derelict, well, they were pretty derelict buildings, the studios I would have in Shoreditch, which you wouldn't have to pay any rent for because the landlord was just happy that somebody was in there not smashing them up. So you'd pay sort of like £10 a week and have no heating and very dodgy lighting.
I lived in a similar place for 10 years. Yeah, we paid £5 a week, but barely had electricity.
So that was sort of built into the paintings as well, that sense of derelict. No, and I was surrounded, even though I never saw Joy Division, and I wasn't from Manchester, I was from Norfolk. That sense of derelict space was all over Norwich as well, so I knew what it was. I knew what it was like. I sort of encountered it very much, and it was very important because very often there were spaces to escape to. That sense of echoing, breaking glass. And the sense of there seems to be no great hope for the future. Not that it was that maudlin necessarily. It was just all because it was everything you knew.
No expectations.
As an artist, I mean, as a work, did Peter Saville's artwork for the Joy Division and the New Order records after Joy Division ended when Ian killed himself, did you find Peter's artwork very interesting, inspiring?
Hugely. It was his work he was making then had a sort of bigger effect than any artist, probably, because the images of... I didn't particularly come from a background of knowing a great deal about sort of painting. I came from rural Norfolk, and sort of I knew images from books, but I certainly knew record covers. So that my first introduction to art was probably record covers. And the Joy Division covers, in various ways, you know, allowed this sort of monumental sense of campness in some sense, because he would allow himself to use very kitsch imagery that otherwise wouldn't sort of, but used in a very sort of straight-jacketed, simple way. And I love that sort of conjunction of sort of the kitsch and the neoclassical together. I mean, very subtly put together.
It's interesting that a thread that seems to connect what you're both saying and also the music and Peter's astonishing artwork for the albums as well is a kind of an abuttal, a putting together of something which is on the one hand very deeply emotional, invested with tremendous feeling and warmth, but is absolutely on a sort of axis, almost synonymous with a totally icy, industrial, cold impersonality. And I've sometimes felt, I don't know, do we have some images of Glenn's art we could look at?
They just have the one.
Can we go back to Glenn? Yeah, thank you.
That I sometimes felt looking at your paintings, and also with the way you've responded for the book for Enna Tharman, that this is something in your art, a sort of that there is intense romanticism, but there's also a coldness, that there's a control, it's the very, very precise balance that somehow you achieve through the way you paint, mm-hmm. the way you draw.
Yes, it's creating that balance between being appearing to be absolutely unfeeling, cold and meticulous in the way I paint, but painting expression nonetheless. And I love the way that Joy Division were both a band you could dance to and a band that were very maudlin and slow at the same time, and that was something that seemed quite new to me. The first time I came across Fantin Latour was on the cover of Power, Corruption and Lies. Yeah. I don't think I would have encountered, as a teenager, would have encountered Fantin Latour anywhere else. And that sort of cemented him in my brain as a very important artist. And he was, the drawings in the book are taken from Fantin Latour paintings. So there is a link there. But there's also that sense of the cut flower representing something which is obviously, all paintings, they're not living flowers, they're in the process of dying. They're in a vase, which is obviously a man-made structure, and these living things are being put in there so people can watch them die. So again, there's a sort of wonderful maudlin sense of what a flower is, and the way I've drawn them, turning them to these rather baroque sort of abstracted shapes, and then layering one image on top of another, hopefully gives them this sense of fragility, and it's almost like an epileptic seizure.
Yes.
The way that the
yeah.
two images overlay, and you can't quite make anything out properly. Yeah. There's a sort of disjuncture there purposefully.
Yeah.
Michael, you say something about your relationship with Joy Division and how they've shaped you as a writer. Because you were much closer to the actual scene.
The straight answer to that is that I, you know, like with Glenn saying living in rural Norfolk and you were living in
Essex. Village.
I mean, I was living in the very uncool London, leafy London suburbs. But I think what distinguished that period, and I'm sure there's lots of people here who had a similar, was that during about 1976 and maybe 1983, if you happened to be in late teens, early adulthood, you would brave almost any journey to try to get to see something. You had this astonishing sense of being pulled towards something that seemed to have a particular, almost an elemental relevance to you, as though if you missed it, you'd be missing something that was very urgent. And I kind of, lo and behold, one day there was at the Nashville in West Kensington, which was a pub not far from Olympia, just near West Kensington Tube. The factory sample tour turned up, and it was three bands playing in the pub. It was Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark, who were supporting a certain Racier, who in turn was supporting Joy Division. And so me and a friend kind of trekked in from, you know, pretty much the border with Surrey, you know, and went to this. And I remember there was a little back room, and it was just a back room in a pub, and Anthony Wilson was in there, and he was rolling a joint. And we, of course, had turned up with our big fringes and our long raincoats and our copies of Kafka, expecting a kind of seminar on existentialism. And what we were greeted with were pure Manchester lads. There was no formality, there was no distinction between backstage and front of stage. They were quite nervous. We sort of were thinking, you know, I'm sure that's the band. And they're sort of going, you're right, you know, kind of. And so, all good. Orchestral Maneuvers in the Dark were utterly forgettable. They had a reel-to-reel tape recorder on stage with sort of very basic, kind of, like, simplistic electro. And the rest of it was kind of actually, you know, the singer's hair. You know, it was a shoulder-length afro. It wasn't cool. And certain ratio were a bit of a mess. But it sounds a cliche, and forgive me, and I'm not being generationally nostalgic, but when Joy Division hit the stage, the precision with which they hit the first five notes, and there was a very strange thing that used to happen when Joy Division performed, and I'm sure it was just something because they didn't have a very good mixing desk or whatever, but Curtis would normally say, good evening, we're Joy Division. And his voice would go very low and transatlantic. He sounded almost like Scott Walker. And as he said, good evening, we're Joy Division, something in the wiring split his voice into two channels. So it echoed, it went into a ghost. You heard this, good evening, we're Joy Division, good evening, we're Joy Division. And it's like his personality fractured. And then Stephen Morris is a very, very, as we know, precise drummer. And they when I saw them, I think they opened with New Dawn Faith. No, with Dead Souls. And it was, yeah, I mean, it was very powerful. But, I mean, I was thinking about, it's very difficult. I don't know if you two had this experience, but it's very difficult to respond directly, isn't it, to maybe music that you've been inspired to. You know, one's afraid of seeming cheesy or corny or... And
when you might, do you have music playing?
No, because writing is cadence, and so I can't have anything intentional with that, no. Music is my release. I get really tired of words, and then I can, you know, I will sort of teach all day and get in the car and put on Joy Division or Earth, Wind and Fire or Miles Davis or something. But I envy music what I envy painting, which is it can free itself from words.
Do you think?
No, I was just thinking about. I mean, it's quite important also to mention the difference between the records and the live performances. Mm. But, because the records are quite different to how they were in performance, but they did have this fundamental and very unusual structure as a band in that you had a high-in-the-mix melodic bass, and then these riffs, I mean, what you're saying, those little guitar riffs, they're sort of trapped, repetitive, and then, you know, and then it would all sort of break down. And then this drumming, which felt like it was circling the song, this very percussive, rapid as if he was kind of drawing a line round and round. It was just like nothing. It had a very physical effect, and I think that's, it still does. I was listening on the bus coming in, and I think it's a very physical effect.
So, I mean, you, when last year there was an interesting book was published called So This Is Permanent, and it was the lyrics, Ian Curtis's lyrics. It also had a wonderful appendix, or two appendices, which were letters that had been written to Ian by fans, which were really, really interesting and of the time, because they were so unpretentious, so sort of...
There was the Belgian one that said, "People are vulgar, I feel dispirit."
Yes.
Which was, but there was also... "Hi Ian, met you in the pub, have you got any more badges?"
Yes. And there was one that said, "Sorry, my brother is a tit."
Yes. It really captured, you know, in those days, just what you're saying. You walked into the venue and you weren't sure who the band were. And they were running their own publicity, so they took your address and they would send you, Ian Curtis would send people badges. And, you know, flyers and things. He wrote back to people and he kept those letters.
I mean, it's a strange, strange thing. And I, as I say, I sort of got a little bit involved in this thing that's happening in Manchester. And I was talking to Peter Saville yesterday afternoon. And he said, and it's the second time he's said it, and I'm sure, Paul, you'll have heard him say the same thing, which is that Factory Records, who released these albums and Peter worked for, was a co-founder of. And Peter said that the equity investment in Factory Records was death. And that I think now, all these years later, there's something... I imagine we'd all be equally suspicious about over-intellectualising, you know, what is essentially a very visceral sensory thrill of rock music. You know, it's something, you know, it's very direct, very physical, it's not trying to be, you know, the lyrical ballads or something.
Yeah, and I don't buy this idea that song lyrics are poetry. I think song lyrics are an equally valuable and important medium. They're not lesser, but they are a different application of words.
I mean, I wanted to ask you, because you wrote, warming to my theme, that you wrote an incredibly good essay or review for the London Review of Books when Ian Curtis's lyrics were published. And I can't imagine that was an easy commission. I mean, A, the idea of, you know, your tummy would get a bit weird writing about Ian Curtis in the London Review of Books anyway, but...
I just focused because it's a marvellous book with them. It's got two very short, perfect introductions, one by Ian Curtis's widow, Deborah Curtis, which has a heartbreaking kind of clarity to her understanding of who he was trying to be and why it wasn't possible for him anymore. And then there's a very concise overview of setting the music in its time by John Savage, who's done so much to... bring to us the culture of the music of the time. And then the book has facsimiles of Ian Curtis's notebooks. He just used, you know, rule, it looks like shopping lists, really. And he would write, and then he would edit, and then all the drafts are included. And it's not nearly as tedious or pedantic as that sounds. It's actually fascinating because he would unanchor things, so it would be... "The bedroom's so cold, you turned away on your side," and he'd cross it out and play with "my bedroom, the bedroom, I turned, you turned." And it was as if he was focusing on, he knew, like actually like any good writer should, that the importance is in the verb and actually that you are focusing on an experience and not so much on the narrative detail. In the way that his small words float up out of those songs, so even though they do have deeply literary balladian references and so on, it's the "I tried to get to you," or that repetition at the end of Disorder where it just the word "feelings" is repeated into obliteration.
It's an extraordinary thing. I mean, I always wanted to know then whether has any other, this isn't a silly question, has any other music influenced your painting, your choice of subjects, the way you paint, Or was it a fairly unique relationship that you had with...
It was a fairly unique relationship, I have to say. There hasn't been any other one band, group, musician which has really had an influence. I mean, I would say that Handel has a massive influence in terms of the formation of the way he writes music, and Baroque music particularly does in the work that I make now, especially the drawings I make. That sense of no straight lines, the sort of antithesis of neoclassicism. But it is something quite peculiar, and it does, for some strange reason, Joy Division don't seem like a band that you can overly intellectualise. Mm-hmm. There are lots of bands which you makes you get feel a bit silly about, being a bit too straight about. They do seem to have aged rather well. Mm-hmm. The music still can be appreciated. I mean, they're not sort of massively complex in anything, but from the production, because I only know them from the records. I mean, I've seen live footage of them, but obviously that's not like listening to them live. So I just know the way that they've been, the albums were produced, in that sort of very beautiful way that the recording studio was used as another instrument.
Mm. Can I ask you, Glenn, when I first saw these paintings, even though we think of the Joy Division imagery being northern and industrial and very much of that time and place, these made absolute sense to me as paintings about Joy Division. And I wondered if, when you were that age and listening to that music, did you have a sort of imperative of escape or release from the life and the world you were in?
Well, these were painted when I was in my 20s, so it was after I initially encountered Joy Division, obviously, which was in my teens. And so there's almost two points at which I'm listening to them, and this is the second point. So I think when I was listening to them again in my 20s, after art college, I was appreciating them more. The sort of the literary ideas were deeper and stronger, and I felt I could properly listen to them again after the sort of initial, because to some extent I encountered them as a band my brother was more interested in than I was. My brother introduced me to a lot of music. He was a sort of punk, and he would go out sort of hitchhiking around England, sort of listening to various bands, and I would hear tales and listen to records and things from him. So it was very often sort of second-hand that I was getting sort of punk and post-punk music. I'm not trying to illustrate the sort of Joy Division. It was a coincidental formation at the same time that Joy Division were around, and I was feeling this way about how to move forward into the future. I was trying to think, where is science fiction? Where is escapism? Where do we go to now? All I can do is go to the past, because the past is now, you know, part of my present. The future is well at hand, as the title goes. And it's just sort of that sort of trying to go back to the, you know, these science fiction images were painted in by Chris Foss in the 1970s. So by the time I was using them in the late 1980s, they were already 20 years out of date, but that was still the vision of the future that we had. And so that crossover between past, present and future was all confused to me, and that was interesting.
We had even a nostalgic idea of the future, because we were reading Clockwork Orange about kind of decades after. We didn't have anything else. We had no other vision of the future than the ones that came from 10, 20 or more years before.
There's a Clockwork Orange and Barbarella was sort of like, that was the feature.
A lot of Tilly Noir.
I mean, I know John Savage has got this interesting idea in one of his books where he talks about time travel in relation to music. I think he actually brought out a collection of essays called Time Travel. And I think that idea, which for me it's caught so brilliantly in these, and I have to say also in the new drawings that you've made for this book, is that idea that I've also heard it from Gilbert and George as well, that they feel that something comes alive for them, whether it's a piece of music or writing or art or whatever, it comes alive for them when it simultaneously contains the past, the present and the future. And so an example they would give, for instance, is perhaps, you know, the paintings of John Martin, for instance, these big sort of Babylonian scaled, you know, they feel that this has elements of the past, the present and the future in terms of the feeling of it. And it's not really a rational thing. It's not something that you could, you know, put into academic language, but I think it's true. And I think with Joy Division, it's interesting. I heard this story, which probably everybody knows, that before they became Joy Division, they were called Warszawa or Warsaw. And they took that name because of David Bowie's instrumental piece with Brian Eno on Low, which was called Warsaw, and it's a deeply kind of industrial instrumental piece of music. And it, what you were saying earlier, you were both saying earlier, to the young members of Joy Division, it was empty Manchester, it was Manchester in the snow, it was all those broken windows and whatever. So they called themselves Warsaw. And then this strange kind of little bit of magic happened, that Poland became, or an idea of Poland became weirdly synonymous on a cultural frequency with an idea of Manchester. And that it's almost like there was this received idea, this balance of, you know, somehow thinking there was something Soviet East European about Manchester in the late 70s. And I mean, I lived with somebody for 20 years who was a big part of this scene, and so I sort of heard it from the lion's mouth, so to speak. But then I heard, which kind of rather capped it, I was in Warsaw, and I went to visit the studio of an artist called Edward Kaczynski, and his estate was represented by this outfit called Foxhole Gallery Foundation. And they told me that when their gallery began, as almost like a state-approved outpost of the avant-garde, to keep it under, you know, it's okay, you know, we'll let you do that because it's avant-garde art, so you're not a political threat. So they were allowed to function. And under the conference table, there was a piece of glass on their conference table, and slipped under it was a photograph of Ian Curtis. And they had had exactly the same thought, that a few bootleg cassettes had come in of Joy Division, and they had responded in the same way, that this is sort of something we recognize, something, some strange frequency. And
presumably none of Joy Division ever went to Warsaw. It was a place of,
I mean, I'm sure they played there as New Order, they've been to Poland, but I know, I mean, it's but I just sort of, coming back to your paintings and to Lavinia's beautiful poems in this book, I think it's, as we say, it's a mistake to over-intellectualize it, but I think it's interesting trying to find a way of translating one's personal feelings about a band into some experience that can be commonly understood, which I think you've both achieved incredibly well with these responses to the band.